It's Friday. My name is Alan O'Donoghue. This is the Teach Computing podcast that I record every Friday. And the point of this podcast is, well, I'm a teacher of computing in Preston in the north of England. I've been teaching computing for about 4 or 5 years now. And I record this podcast every week to give people kind of ideas and share with them my successes and my failures so that they don't make the same mistakes if possible. Although it is good to make mistakes because you learn a lot from mistakes. And trust me, I've learned quite a lot over the last couple of years from making lots of mistakes. So today, actually, it's not Friday. It's Saturday morning. And I've been on my Easter holidays first week. And I've just arrived at Media City, which is in Salford near Manchester, for a one-day conference called Update. And it's really all about games industry. Now, I haven't really got much of a clue what to expect from today, so I'm going to go around, I'm going to talk to a few people, find out why they're here, what are they doing, and stay tuned. So the first two suspects or victims or that I've bumped into are Dan and Si. Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about, are you teachers or what do you do?
I work at BBC, I work in CBeebies, I'm a producer, I make sort of TV shows mostly, but I'm also a gamer as well. So I'm involved in making games at work, and but I'm a game player.
So there's a huge overlap for you between the things you enjoy and the things that you're working with.
Yes. Make your hobbies into your job and then you'll be happy, that's the idea, yeah.
And Si, are you in the same kind of...
I work with, again, for the BBC, but I worked specifically on games, but for the whole BBC. And I did exactly that. I made games my job because I just went around talking about games until somebody listened and kind of made me do it, really, which has been brilliant. I'm here today to meet a load of new people. Northwest games industry is incredibly important and valuable to what we do at the BBC. We're based at Media City, so having a load of games devs come in to Media City, it feels like a good opportunity to welcome them and talk to them.
But today's event, it's not a BBC event.
No, not at all.
It seems like it's an independent thing called Update Show.
So it's Update Show. It's organised by one of the guys on the Manchester Indie Game Devs Facebook group, which is how I found out about it. And I just really embrace the way the Northwest networks and gets all kinds of different diverse people and companies together to talk about games, and this is a great space. I mean, we're in the Iberbia Labs, which is really, really fun to see all their kind of testing and the opportunities for kind of that. It's just a really fun day, and you know, kind of it's a day that doesn't feel like work, which is great.
Do you think this is a real growth area, like in terms of one, geographically where it is, but also in terms of future media and all of that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the BBC committed to a 30-year lease here, which is a pretty impressive commitment to the area and to kind of keeping the place going. And, you know, I've been here now, I've been in Manchester for kind of 4 years and been working at Salford for like the last three, and seeing the growth, seeing the new companies, seeing shops and support pop up, seeing the events start to take place. I mean, today there's like four events going on all at once, you know, garden parties,
games events.
And everything. And that sense of life is hugely important for the area. It's hugely important for the regeneration of the Docklands around it. It's massive. And it's kind of one of those things that's been really, really exciting to be a part of and to be at the forefront and kind of...
So you may be aware that back in October, I think it was on the 8th of October, the Director General of the BBC made an announcement that about the future direction and how it was going to be all around things like digital creativity and the arts. Was that exciting news for you, or did you kind of think?
Absolutely. The BBC is sort of doing loads of amazing things, and I mean, in children's as well. Children's has been made kind of one of the priorities for the BBC to invest in, and that's brilliant too. And that's what's so brilliant about children's, I find, is that actually that's always right at the very forefront of all this sort of future media, games, technology development, because the kids kind of are there first, you know. So it's exciting. It really is exciting times.
So now I'm a teacher. Can I ask, when you were at school, were you already doing things like this yourself at school, or were there teachers who kind of opened your eyes to this kind of thing? Or
BBC microcomputers, Granny's Garden, and there was a Dragon game.
Dragon 32.
Might be, yeah. No, but there was a game with red and green dragons.
Oh, sorry, on the BBC Microcomputer.
Yeah, yeah, and there was a brilliant one where you had to build a Roman fort. And so, yeah, that was my... But my dad also could have... We had a ZX81, and we used to play games on that. Well, I call them games, but they were kind of like
it was low-res graphics.
Pixel experiences, that's right. I think you probably call them.
So those early experiences for you, you think have had a big influence on where you are now,
yes? Totally. Yeah. Although, what really put me off going into games was with my Commodore 64, having those magazines with like kind of 42 pages of code. In, yeah. And I had no idea what code was or what I was doing. I just bought the magazine and I'd spend like the whole weekend programming it and then, you know, typing it all in. And then you press go and there'd be a syntax error, and I didn't know what a syntax error was, and the game wouldn't work very well. And then when you got it to work, it was very disappointing. but you know, you'd actually had the power to change it. And it was that, you know, that thing of being able to type something in and for it to happen was just like really inspiring. But also just the games and the kind of things you could do with games as they developed as well, which just became really exciting. Different ways of you know, playing with your mates and that kind of thing.
There was a lot of challenge though, wasn't there, then? Because in order to do something, you had to learn a lot. Do you think that now those challenges are still there for people? Like if you want to decide, like these games that we're looking at around here today, do you think if you're going to go and build one of those, you have to learn all about like text-based programming?
Well, no, I don't know. I'm just learning about that myself. I'm just trying to teach myself how to make games at the moment. And I found it quite difficult to find out how to do it. But
I've sort of... Speak to me, I'll help you out.
Yes, this is it. When I'm being, yeah, and so I will, actually. Yes, yeah.
So is that something that you're familiar with, text-based programming? Or
So your question about whether it was teachers, it was definitely teachers.
Yeah.
Because teachers... who champion the device and put it in the classroom.
Like the BBC Micro and Dan.
And then learned even a little bit what it could do and were motivated by kind of the curiosity around this technology. That rubs off on the kids, absolutely. And I think that, you know, if I look, like, and I look at the, then when I move into secondary school and the teachers, the science walkway, in my school was where the computer was, and that's where I spent my lunch times, completely mad Professor Mariotti on the BBC Acorn A3000.
Do you think the teachers might have been frightened of you because perhaps you knew a little bit more than they did about some?
This is something that actually really resonates with me. It's really, really important to me. It's because my late father brought computers into our home, and actually on reflection, having looked back at our life. He's a few years past, but I reflect on it often. He was always obsessed with technology. He didn't know what it all did. He just bought it, and we had terrible. And I knew a lot more than him. And I remember really, really clearly one day he sat there and he came into the living room, and I'd taken the computer to bits, and he was just sat there with a horrified look. He's like, "What have you done?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm just like changing the memory or cleaning the hard drive or, you know, replacing the hard drive or whatever I was doing." And he was just like, "Can you put it back together?" I'm like, yeah, no worries, not a problem at all. And he sat there and watched me, and I was like, "You don't have to watch me. Like, I'm just going to fix it, don't worry." And it's not until many years later I realised that that moment for him was one of complete awe, that what he couldn't quite do, I was so naturally taken to, and that all of the advances that just felt like, I was like, "Why are you even watching me?" But to him, that was a moment that kind of I can understand now that I couldn't understand then. And I think that for teachers, I don't think there's anything to be scared of when your students overtake you or your students understand something more intrinsically than you ever will, because that's human progress.
That process of power. Invention and discovery exploration. Yeah.
And that's what sent us to the moon, and that's what will send us to Mars, and that's what will send us, you know, out of this world and into others. It's massive.
Do you think that, as you know, when we're children, that we're kind of a little bit less averse to taking risks, and that we will pull things apart to see how they work, whereas adults, we're kind of a little bit like, "Oh no, don't do that."
And also, I think we've done ourselves a terrible disservice in technology by making everything easy. You know, I find it incredible that people are fascinated that kids can operate mobile phones. Mobile phones were designed for adults.
Sure.
They were designed to make things simple for adults because adults are rubbish at technology. Not for kids. Don't be amazed by your kid. If your kid can program a 1980s VCR like I could, right, then I'm going to be impressed.
Yeah.
All right. You know, reading the like badly translated Hong Kong manual and then getting hold of that giant remote with 900 buttons and getting it to record Back to the Future when you're out for Christmas, like, you know, Christmas drinks. That, if you can do that when you're seven, all right, come and talk to me. Right now, if you can press a button on an iPhone, I'm not that interested. Yeah.
But what was it that gave you the confidence to take apart the computer, though?
But you've got no sense of what things are worth.
That's right. That's what I'm saying.
There's a value attached to it. But
so you just remembered how you took it apart and put it back in the same way that you remembered it.
Yeah, and when it didn't work and it broke, you know, I learned incredibly quickly. When I destroyed my dad's first hard drive by formatting it and seeing the big red bar going across and then being like, I don't know if I should have done that, and cancelling it. But the days before, formatting a hard drive was a safe thing you could cancel, and I destroyed a drive. You know,
one of the things I remember, I had I'm a little bit older than
20 megabyte hard drive, I should have. 20 megabytes.
Yeah,
I remember one of the things my mother bought me a Sinclair Spectrum from Woolworths. They were £99 then from Woolworths. Yeah. And I wanted to do lots of interfacing with it, and the Sinclair Spectrum was rubbish for doing that, whereas the BBC Micro was a lot, the protection was a lot better on it.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that at the time.
So I had a big track, and I was trying to interface my Sinclair Spectrum, but what I hadn't realised was, because there was no such a protection, as soon as you connected a motor to the circuit, they had like an expansion port in the back. What those motors were effectively doing were trying to pull lots of power through, and it just zapped it. And I went back to my mum and said, the computer's not working. And she said, well, it's got a 12-month guarantee. We'll take it back. And I think Woolworths eventually, became on a first-name basis with them, because we went in so often. And luckily, we had that 12-month guarantee. We could keep going in and doing that all the time.
And the person who was doing the guarantee didn't understand why it was working.
No, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I did a lot of my early computer experimentation in labs at school. There was always that one. I mean, I grew up in a village in East Anglia, and there's that one guy in the village who knew computers or worked in computers, and I was round his house all the time, and I think he got irritated with me now and again, but he would always, you know, give me a disc or a new program or a new bit of tech to try and mess around with. And, you know, I kind of like, yeah, I mean, some of the stuff's pretty expensive, but like the enthusiast kits now are incredibly accessible, like, you know, things like Raspberry Pis are awesome, then Little Bits and all of the Arduinos and that. Those kits are dirt cheap when you compare it to the £600 smartphone that you can barely do anything with in your pocket. You know, it's like, so it's just...
What do you think about Lego
Mindstorms
as well?
Yeah. Lego, I missed Lego Mindstorms. Lego Mindstorms is one of those things that arrived a little bit too late for me. But that stuff, like programming robots and stuff, I mean, that's... appeals to certain people.
I mean, what is great when you're talking about the Raspberry Pi is that it allows all those kind of things to happen, and if it blows up or you damage it like mine does, £20 to replace it's not the end of the world. But what has been a challenge in the past is
breaking a screen on a phone.
Well, yeah, I have done that. Yeah, and suddenly it's worth nothing. The experience that you were talking about in your sitting room when you took the computer apart and put it all back together and it didn't work.
Yep.
I mean, I want children in my classroom to have that kind of experience, but I'd get sacked if we were trashing computers all the time. And that's the nice thing about the Raspberry Pi, that if it does get trashed,
why things like Project Kano are so interesting. Yeah. So Project Kano is taking
the Raspberry Pi and packaging it
as a make-your-own-computer kit. So there's a keyboard in there, and you have to do a load of steps, and then you've actually got to compile the operating system. And then when the operating system's compiled, you've then got to compile and write bits of the program. So it's got a version of... a pseudo version of Minecraft on it. You can't run Minecraft until you've programmed enough of it to make Minecraft work. So it's Kickstarter, right?
Yeah.
So it's not in production yet. But
you can download the operating system that they've created. You can actually download that now. They've made that available. They've open sourced it.
Weird.
Yeah.
Someone made a brilliant. I spoke at Vision 2022, which was. A conference the BBC did for students, and I've spoken at a few of those over the years to try and inspire people to take a step into STEM subjects, to try and progress forward to engineering and software. It's like, hey, this is what you can do with your career, and I find that really, really valuable, because it's an opportunity for me to pass on things that no one ever told me I could do computers at university early enough, right? And there was literally right at the last minute, I'm just about to hand in my UCAS form, and someone's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm doing chemical engineering, and they're like, you spend all of your time on that box in that corner. Yeah. Why aren't you doing computers? I had no idea you could do computers. And it was like this revelation to me. So I always, I know that even with the internet, even with this, that adults are the influencers, and adults can remove the blinkers for their children and for the children that they influence, whether they mentor them or they're you know, leaders of community groups or scouts or whatever. So yeah, it's absolutely important to reach the adults and tell them to tell the kids about the opportunities they've got. So I always talk, and then tell the kids, hey, look elsewhere, it's okay. And one of the things that was said to me by a teacher at that conference, which I found absolutely brilliant, it's a really, really acute observation, is there's a missing generation. And that's the generation who didn't get the BBC Micro and right now are not being targeted for computers right now.
And they grew up with maybe a Windows desktop environment where everything was all just a mouse and a keyboard.
Even then, like, people who didn't even look beyond that, you know, I actually think it's even closer. So it's the single button, the protected, you can't do anything, don't worry, you can't break it, it's everything's safe.
It's all behind the glass.
And I get why they did it, right? So businesses were getting people in who were the micro generation or the sort of micro generation, some were engaged, some weren't, and didn't understand office software. And so the businesses said to the government, no one knows how to use Excel, no one can do a spreadsheet, no one can use a computer, I need word processing, we all have these computers, you need to be able to use it. So the school said, okay, we'll train them. They trained them, you know, and that cycle's now, we're going to break that, because like, oh my God, no one can program a computer, we haven't got any programmers.
So. That was when I was first teaching in the 90s, and it was all about office-based thing. And we're teaching children things like how to set up a database and how to manage a database. And I kept thinking, when are they actually ever going to use this?
I'd actually say that, you know, kind of, my wife works in human resources. And so she's got that business back office function that sees the whole of an organisation. She's seen many, many organisations. She said it's incredible how many people at certain stages still can't use that software. Whereas she's a very, very adept at Excel.
But she's using it within a context. If you're teaching databases to a 14-year-old, it seems incredibly abstract.
So we have that kind of thing all the time. It's like, how do you make sure that the lessons you're designing are absolutely placed in a context that will be useful in the future? And I think that that's where, you know, you kind of, you see software engineering, you see games especially, and why we're here, you know, they're a very engaging way to motivate people to participate. I always talk about projects, you know, like digital creativity, the BBC, if you ever come to any of the meetings where I'm ever involved, I'll be running around going, projects, because you have to give someone an outcome which they're motivated to complete in order to get them to do anything at all. And you know, without an end goal, you know, you can write a database, but you know, that's not going to be any use unless that database is powering a website, and that website is managing
your business.
Kind of who's subscribed to you, to your newsletters you're putting out about your Minecraft group or whatever. You know, you have to put those things into context, and I think that's where I hope a network of teaching resources emerges, where people can share the best of their lessons, the best of their approaches to a curriculum, that they can say, hey, you know what, you've got to teach these five things, and you know what, they're not going to be engaged in the way they're proposed to be done, but hey, if you do this, here's the results.
That sounds, in a way, that sounds fantastic, but then when you're in a classroom and you've got 30 children, all from different backgrounds, all this, and you kind of think, well, I'm going to have something I can teach to all those 30, you then do have to kind of, becomes formula-led rather than, let's interview all the children, let's find out what they're interested in, because then you're going to have 30 different lessons happening rather than one.
Yeah. I mean, I don't envy the task ahead of teachers. It's an incredibly difficult. I mean, I enjoy teaching in the times of it. I've never sat in a room with 30 disengaged faces and tried to figure out how to get them motivated.
That's the difficulty too, I would imagine, is because you're not just... It seems that teachers are being asked more and more not just to actually teach something, so to kind of go, hey, let's make a database to show how many users you've got in your Minecraft
game. Yes.
It's kind of like, right, no, they must understand what
these
a database
concepts,
is.
That's right,
In order to be able to add two numbers together and then pull out a result for this reason, you know, and to go for an exam. So you're kind of you have to teach for the test. You just have to, because that's the way the curriculum's set up. It would seem from the outside looking in, and then and so I don't know. I mean, is that the hindrance? Is that the kind of thing where it's kind of actually what teachers are being asked to do? You know, and it's not. Does it feel like you're being given sort of that free rein to be able to kind of adapt your lessons to, you know, to kind of to give them motivating
kind of experiences that they're going to enjoy and remember, like the one you talked about in your sitting room. Right, just before we wrap this up, looking into the future slightly, today is all about games. The next 3 or 5 years, how do you think that the games and the hardware that people are playing today might differ from some of the things that you've seen?
So the most important thing you have to understand about games is if you look at the statistic for how many smartphones are sold every quarter. So I mean, Apple last quarter sold 50 million, right? Now there's going to be an upsell rate, people are converting their phones, but let's say half of that, right, are new owners, right? That's 25 million new people every 3 months, right? Now, you think that in a year, that's 100 million, right? The entire game-playing population registered on Steam, the largest network on PCs, is less than 80 million, right? So you've got more than the entire game-playing population of the most popular PC platform appearing every year. That means more people playing games, and they're different. They're not the people who play Steam. They might be, and maybe some crossover, but in general, you're going to have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of new people looking for a gaming experience. And those gaming experiences are going to come on every device and every possible technology, from the Internet of Things to virtual reality headsets to glasses or wearables or watches or whatever it might be. That just means more people playing games. We're going to get back. I was in the Dublin. I've had coffee, so I talk a lot. I was in Dublin at the Natural History Museum, and they have a Viking exhibit in the National History. And that Viking exhibit had loads and loads of board games, and it had loads of counters and pieces, right, that they unearthed from the excavations around Dublin. And the plaque was really interesting. This was a huge part of society in the Viking Age. What have we done wrong since then? Right, because now we're getting back there, until gaming is going to be a huge part of our society. We're intrinsically motivated to play. It's a fascinating part of society, and I think the difference in the next 3 to 5 years is going to be people playing freely.
But you're saying an increase. You think it's going to be wider audiences.
Everyone is allowed to play now.
Yes.
Right, because they can do it privately.
Yes.
Right, and they don't have that societal kind of Victorian workhouse ethic thing breathing down on them that we pass on for generations. Play is okay. We can do this. Enjoy it, embrace it, and then have a go yourself. And I think that's the biggest change, is that we'll see more and more. Board games are going to get massive increases, card games, social games, Internet of Things, wearables, devices. They're all going to see just a plethora of play, and I think that'll catapult us into a new cultural age.
And in your area as well, actually, will expand more, I think, like we were just talking about. Everything is becoming gamified, in inverted commas, and I think that's what people want to tap into more, won't it? Because of that exact principle.
Well, isn't
people want to play games, and so everyone else who isn't in games will want to bring a game feel or a game approach.
Isn't playing games just an interactive way of storytelling? I mean,
Thousands of years ago,
pre-civilization, people told stories, legends, and all these kind of things. With games, the narrative is still there, but you can change the narrative.
Games are systemic.
Yeah.
I think the biggest differences was, I mean, you can tell stories of systems, right? So, narrative itself is a system. It has structure. Good narrative follows certain patterns that you can kind of reduce it to. And you can engage across that, whether it's a good story or a bad story. If you tell it in the right way, you can progress well. And that's the system around storytelling. And you've got games that are systems, and so stories can emerge, and you can tell stories around things. You can set up, and you give people emotional investment in the outcome of whatever their participatory thing is. So I think that we'll absolutely see innovations in storytelling, but we'll also see huge, huge innovations in gameplay, because more people are playing, and we're going to see more experiments in what those people are interested in. Games of cooperative games about loneliness, games about companionship, games that explore personal journeys and personal stories facilitated from an easy access to technology and tools that allow you to tell those stories in a new way. The whole generation growing up now, for whom interactivity is the absolute default thing they do, will then progress into telling stories using their default mode, which is interactivity. Just look at the new grammar in storytelling that YouTube has emerged. You know, filmmakers are learning from YouTube, because there's 100 million hours uploaded every day of people trying new things. And that kind of experimentation across gameplay, across storytelling in all forms, words, pictures, the moving image. That's why I think we're catapulting into a new.
So you think games are going to absorb everything? Because in a way, stories used to be used sometimes to teach lessons. Like, oh no, you don't want to do that, because that's, look, let me tell you a story. Yeah, when I once did it that way, so it can be used to learn. Mm-hmm. So maybe the classroom, 15, 20 years from now, the classroom won't be in the way that it is, but the classroom will be learning to play.
You'll probably be reducing problem solving to systems in a way that's a lot more like games are now. Mm-hmm. So building mental models of how the world works is a really important part of play. So I do this, what happens? I test this, what happens? I push the boundaries of what I can do physically, mentally, emotionally, socially. And that's how you learn to develop as a human being, I suppose. Well, we reduce those back to systems, whether they be stories or games, in terms of board games and anything like that, to say, what is this? How do I work that? And then you keep practicing your problem-solving skills so that when you go out and test yourself in the real world, in the larger, more complex system,
you've modelled it so many times now that you're prepared.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I think you'll see that problem reduction into gameplay as an intrinsic part of problem solving in the classroom, absolutely.
Right, I'll give you a break. Si and Dan, thank you very much.
No, great. Yeah. That was really interesting.
So I've just come out of the last talk of the day, and it was Alex Johansson.
Yep,
is that right? And on Twitter, you're at Alex versus Coding.
Yep.
At Alex VS Coding.
Yeah, that's right.
So you were telling us about you've done a summer camp over in America. Is that right?
Yeah. I've been teaching abroad for about 3 years in the US, upstate New York.
Are you a qualified teacher?
No.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I mean, the good thing about that is it was kind of just a clean slate when I started the whole.
Yep. Sorry,
can you move your laptop? Yeah. Okay.
Emergency over. They're going to use your laptop. Are we recording? Yeah, we're recording.
Okay.
So you were saying you've been teaching abroad for 3 years.
Yep.
And you, in the talk, you've just been showing about using Stencil.
Yeah.
You were telling us a story about one child who like made an amazing amount of games.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the great thing about the course is that the way that I run it is the kids don't have to follow a set structure, so they can just run wild, essentially, and I just kind of tend to them as they're making all these discoveries.
So you let the children decide what it is that they want to do themselves.
Yeah.
That must cause some problems, because what if you've got 30 different projects going on?
Exactly what happens.
Yeah.
But as I said, the thing that kind of brings it together is this collaborative board that I have. And the thing is, the kids kind of will help each other.
So is this like a board on the wall?
They
like write down in a post-it note, like, how do you add extra lives in, or I want to add
exactly
high
that.
Score table.
And the thing with that is that you have, it's organised into columns, and the idea is that when you kind of solve someone's problem, you move along a tier.
And there's some type of reward built
in. Yeah, the reward is that you get more time with the teacher. So the time that you've saved the teacher, you then get to
to another level.
You get to level up.
The time that
you save the teacher, you then get for you to use and get help from in a project. Because, if there's 30 kids in the classroom, they're realistically only going to get 2 minutes in an hour lesson each. So you can increase your time by helping other people. And that was the kind of the drive behind the project, to take some weight off my back.
And what kind of ideas were the children coming up with? So they were using Stencil, which is kind of scratch looking, but it's got a lot more functionality in it. What were they building with Stencil?
There's been about 250 games that have been kind of produced through the course. There's just been such a variety. There's been like real-time strategies, racing games, fighting. A lot of shooters, a lot of kids wanting to make shooters, but. Games where you play as zombies, dragons, robots, flying around in spaceships.
And what sort of age range were the children?
It's 7 to 17, so it's a full range. A lot of the kids at the younger age are more kind of focused on the visual stuff and build kind of simple platformers. There was one kid who basically rebuilt the entire cast of Star Wars in pixel art.
My goodness,
And then just had a very simple platformer, but he was really proud of it.
And were they all working on their own? Or
on their own.
Yeah.
There was a couple of teams that worked together, but for the most part, I think 90% of the people on it were all on their own. Which is a big feat for a lot of young kids.
Is there any way that anybody can look at some of these games that have been created? Are they in a certain place online?
A lot of the kids were kind of conscious about putting the games online.
Right.
But the thing that I'm going to be pushing for this year is to get the kids. There's a website called itch.io, and that's like a distribution site. And what I'm going to be doing is publishing all of the games on there at the end of the year.
Because one of the great things is when you share something that you've created, you get feedback from other people.
So, I mean, I think what I'm going to do is get some kind of like official French Woods publishing, or not, like a like an archive of all the different games. So it's clear that it's kids' games, so you don't get, you know, people that's coming on saying, it looks terrible, you know, and have kids in tears. But just somewhere where the kids can all, you know, find their games online and their friends can play the games.
That's brilliant, Alex. Well, thank you very much. And it's at Alex versus, yes, that's Cody. BS Cody.
Yeah, that's
thank
right.
you.
That's it. You can listen to more podcasts like this at tinyurl.com/teachcomputingpodcast and follow me at technoteacher, TEKNO teacher.